Welcome to part two of our Opera Day episode with special guest Chris. If you haven't listened to part one yet, please go back and do so before listening to this one. We wrap up our discussion by covering Peter and Sam's songs. I also want to mention that once again, the audio quality suffered simply because we recorded via Zoom. Without further ado, here's the conclusion of our Opera Day episode.
Welcome to Two Songs, One Couple, where a geeky metalhead husband swaps songs
with his nerdy country girl wife. Grab a drink, get comfy, and join us on our musical chat. So, to segue from our last segment into this one, I wanted to talk about Lady Gaga.
What?
Chris, did you see her performance? At the Oscars in 2015, Lady Gaga performed the Sound of Music medley.
That's right, yeah.
And she performed it in a operatic style. And a lot of people were praising her for it. A lot of people forget Lady Gaga is actually a very good musician. She's very good at piano.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And she's a good singer, but she does pop. So people were like, oh my God, she can actually sing.
Which is so like insulting.
Right.
Because pop is singing too.
It is, but it's generally not regarded as technical.
Yeah, which is also bullshit, though, because there are some very technical pop songs, especially like and hip hop songs, too. Like some of Beyonce's songs are really technically difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And some of Lady Gaga's are, too. But boo on snobby people. Poo poo on them.
But of course, she had critics, too. You know who Stephen Sondheim is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He ripped her and said, on the Academy Awards, she was a travesty. This is his quote. This is his words. It was ridiculous, as it would be from any singer who treats that music in semi-operatic style. She had no relationship to what she was singing. What people liked was her versatility. So this kind of goes into what we just talked about popra and how music snobs can see pop singers or non-opera singers, quote unquote, trying to sing opera as inferior.
Mm.
And that is, I don't know, dude.
You know, I would love to have like a blind test to like see if these people would actually have the same criticisms if they didn't know that the singer was first famous for like pop or some other genre.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
I'm willing to bet that like 90% of the time they wouldn't be able to realize who's or identify just by hearing who's had classical training and who's not. I think sometimes it's obvious, but other times, you know, people figure it out and can still sound really, really good and really close to classically trained. And others are classically trained and they sound like trash. I feel like there's some obvious bias being stated there that isn't really reflective of the musical talent.
Yeah, it's just old white man being grumpy. And this motherfucker wrote Into the Woods, so that says it, everything you need to know there.
I like that.
Into the woods. Musical. I'm walking into the woods. Into the woods. I get it. That's the name of the musical. You don't need to remind me, brother.
I like that musical.
Bro.
Read it in.
Hold up. Where are you going? Where are you going, friends? Into the woods. Oh, I forgot. You just mentioned that 10 seconds ago. Stupid ass.
It's interesting, though. It's a little bit of like a reverse snobbery because like, oh, she's singing opera style on my musical or, you know.
Yeah.
On a musical, and it should be sung non-operatic way. It's like, what? Okay. It's
weird.
All right, so that leads me into my song, because this is not an operatic take on it at all, but here we go.
Il nome mio nessun saprà, no, no,
My song is Nessun Dorma by Manowar. Manowar is an American heavy metal band formed in New York. Their style of music typically leans classic heavy metal and power metal, and they're actually huge in Europe. But in the US, they're not very well known. Like, I didn't really know much about them until I saw some sort of documentary on them. They were playing these festivals, and they had a huge cult following. People tattooed with Manowar tattoos, huge crowds, and it was all in Europe. But here, meh. They are known for being in the Guinness Book of World Records as the loudest band, which Guinness has stopped doing because you can imagine a competition like this can be very dangerous.
Yeah.
So they recorded it in 1984, Guinness did, that they are the loudest band. And then Manowar actually beat those records, but Guinness said, no, we don't want anything to do with this anymore. We don't want to encourage hearing damage. They also hold the world record for the longest heavy metal concert. They played for 5 hours and 1 minute in Bulgaria in 2008.
Oh, God.
They have dubbed themselves the quote unquote manliest band in the world. I don't know if you've seen pictures of this band. They're kind of the gayest band in the world. Just like pictures of them oiled up, shirtless, things like that, or in tons of leather.
Like homoerotic.
Yeah, it is manly in that way. But like when you say manliest band in the world, there's a connotation there. And it's like not what I expected.
I don't want to get into this, but like, yeah, what does that even mean nowadays? Yeah,
exactly. Right? Exactly. But back in 1980, I'm sure it had a different connotation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the band just kind of formed from humble beginnings. I don't really want to get into how they formed. That's not really important. But I do want to bring up a cringe fact about this band. Carl Logan, their guitarist, not an original guitarist, but their guitarist from 94 to 2018, he was arrested on child porn charges. And he allegedly possessed porn of like little girls from 4 to 12, an age range.
Ew.
Pretty gross. So immediately they're like, fuck this guy. They kicked his ass out of the band.
Good.
Yeah. So this band is a heavy metal band. And as far as I know, none of them are like trained musicians. Maybe they are, but I know the singer is not. And so this is a metal band. So to frame it in that context, they're doing a cover. We've just established what a cover is in this world. A cover of a pretty famous opera song, opera aria, called Nessun Dorma. And Nessun Dorma comes from, oh, it's fucking Puccini again, huh?
Surprise, surprise.
I know.
Mr. Puccini.
I know. Puccini, opera called Turandot. The opera was technically unfinished because he died in 1924, and Franco Alfano completed it in 1926.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so the plot of this goes, there's a, I guess, a princess named Turandot. And if you want to marry Turandot, you have to answer these three riddles correctly. And then Calef, I don't know how to pronounce these names. Sorry, Calef, an unknown prince shows up out of seemingly nowhere and answers these riddles to win her love. He answers the questions, and then Turandot was like, oh God, I don't really want to marry this guy. And so she begs her father not to give, you know, not to give her to the stranger. But Calef, of course, hoping to win her love, is persistent and doesn't give up. It even poses this challenge that if you can learn my name by dawn, I will forfeit my life. So that's her out, right? Anyway, what the fuck is this shit, dude? What is this? This is all fantastical, like we talked about, all like way over the top. Liu is Turandot's slave girl. She knows the name of the prince, but doesn't give it up to Turandot. And I guess ends up killing herself.
Damn.
To hold on to the secret. All in the name of love. I don't know. I just kind of read it as a synopsis.
It's fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, and also, like, you already found out, like, how fucked up the princess is, and you still want to marry her?
Mm-hmm.
So that's another fucked up thing.
There's a lot of problematic shit in here.
I know this.
It's like, you know, the princess just being shipped off and given as a prize by her dad. Kind of fucked up. She doesn't want to. And to get out of it, she goes to extreme measures, like you said. And this is all based on Asian characters, Chinese, I think, specifically. Really? Like, her slave girl is named Liu, L-I-U.
What?
And there are characters in it. The three ministers of state, their names, Ping, Pang, and Pong.
Are you serious? No way.
Uh-huh. So here we go. Nessun Dorma, it translates to Let No One Sleep. And it's the aria of the final act. And sung by a male. So the main character, Caliph, expresses his triumphant assurance that he will win the princess. This was a very odd duck when I came across this. I was listening to Manowar and put on the CD, which is off of their 2002 album, Warriors of the World. I think I picked it up at Rasputin for cheap, threw it in my CD player, but this song stuck out like a sore thumb. It's like, what is this song doing here? I recognized it right away that it was a classical or opera. And I've come to find out that Eric Adams is the lead singer, the vocalist. He wanted to include this in this album as a tribute to his mother that died earlier that year.
I read somewhere else that it's also a tribute for his Italian fans.
Mm.
Which would make sense. Maybe it's both, you know, you can have more than one tribute.
Yeah, that's enough of me talking about it. Let's have you all give your impressions. Let's start with you, Chris. What did you think?
So this is where I'm showing my bias. Hopefully not snobbery. But since it's such a popular song,
mm-hmm.
and I've heard so many versions of it, like operatic style, I think my first listen to it was just kind of like a little jarring because it was so popera, like his timbre. You know that he's like a good singer, but just not this genre, right? And because I guess in my mind, I was just kind of comparing between those two. Like it was hard for me to get over the hump initially that, oh, you know, he's just singing Nessun Dorma with like a very pop take on it, or even heavy metal, right?
Yeah.
But I think also like after learning some of the context too, like, you know, it's tribute to his mom, or and also like he's doing this for his Italian fans, then I think like that helped me also, like, because initially I was just like, why did he throw this song in the album, right? It's kind of like a little bit out of place, right?
It is.
And also him singing it, but now it makes so much sense.
I agree with that. It is out of place on that album because it caught my ear too.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all these heavy metal songs, and all of a sudden this song is on here. Like, why?
And then I guess the other thing was I'm also used to hearing, you know, like a full orchestra playing all the parts and stuff like that. And this is more kind of like maybe electronics. Am I right? I'm not sure.
Yeah, like it sounds, at least the opening orchestral line, quote unquote, it sounds like a patch on a key, like a MIDI.
Yeah,
cheap MIDI sound.
Yeah, that was a little bit also like I'm not used to that. But I did like in the end where, like, you know, he put the heavy metal twist, you know, the guitar at the end and made it like he made it his own, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or like a tribute for his fans. So like, you know, like if you don't like it, then fuck you. Like, I don't care. Like, this is my spin. And, you know, this is a tribute to like my mom and my fans. So, yeah, I think like after a few listens, I was like, oh, okay, I get it. I guess I would say initially, like, it was hard for me to not compare with the other versions or maybe the more operatic singers who sang this song. And I was expecting, you know, like him to hold that, you know, I don't know what note is that, a B flat? No, like a G, or I don't know what it is. The one before the last note, like that's kind of like the golden note that everyone holds for like, I don't know, 5 seconds or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And because, you know, if you're not classically trained, you cannot hold that note. It's super hard. So yeah, I was like doing those comparisons. But I mean, overall, I liked his rendition and what he was trying to convey with his, as you call it, cover. Like, I think that made a lot of sense and it was actually pretty sweet, I think.
Do you feel that you have a perspective that the opera snobs feel when they see Sarah Brightman or Andrea Bocelli try to sing? They're like, it's not what it should be.
Yeah.
Do you think they have that reaction too?
I think so. Because it's just what you're used to hearing, right? And anything that's kind of like out of the norm, you're just like, ugh. Especially if it's not kind of like, you already have like a mindset of or expectation of what this song should sound like, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think give yourself a little bit of credit, Chris, because I don't think you're being snobby about it, because I think you're being fair about it. It's just you prefer one version over another. You're not ripping them a new one. You're not saying, ugh, how dare a metal band cover an opera song. You're being super fair about it. The snobbery comes in when you can't at least provide a fair assessment and at least acknowledge that, hey, my bias or my preferred version is something other than this one, but it's not terrible.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
That's essentially
like,
the takeaway.
I would never say that Eric's a shitty singer after hearing it. It's just he has a pop metal style.
Yep.
And he's singing a song that's, well, to me, you know, I'm used to hearing more operatic style. So
yeah. Do you prefer Pavarotti's version? That's probably the version I would go to if I were to choose another one.
I'm not a Pavarotti fan.
What?
Oh no.
I feel, yeah, like I said, like I prefer like a little bit more soft opera sound, and Pavarotti, just his voice is amazing, right? It pierces
Yes.
through everything,
Yes.
including my eardrums. So I'm sorry. I know he's like, a legend, like in terms of expression and singing, but just like you said, it's like my preference, right? It's just not for me. Like he is like, one of the greatest of all time tenors, of course. But for me, I'm just like, I don't listen to him when I want to relax. I cannot relax with that piercing bright tone that, of course, it's getting me engaged, but I'm on the edge of my seat when I listen to him. So
It's not how you want to be engaged, right?
yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Similar to Sarah Brightman, and you know how I watched a opera, more traditional opera version of her song. Did the same thing here with Nessun Dorma by watching Pavarotti's version. And it is like you said, Chris, where it's like he projects a lot and it just really like punches you in the eardrum, like you said. But that very last note that he hit, that you mentioned too, where the last note that you hold on to, and like that's the part where everyone loses their mind and everyone just like creams their pants because it's like, oh my God, it's a loud note and it's very high and he's holding it. Yeah, his version's very, very good. It's probably the de facto standard when it comes to versions of this song. And so I can see, in fact, I have seen, the comparison of like, what is this metal band doing opera for? And people are trying to compare it to the original in an operatic sense when it should be judged in a more metal sense. And it's his take on it, and it's not meant to be the original opera version.
Yeah, and he had a purpose for it. Tribute to his mom, for his Italian fans,
Yeah.
like he couldn't give a shit. Like if the opera snobs are like, "Well, you didn't sing it like Pavarotti." He's like, "That's not the point, right?"
Right. Okay, Sam, what did you think?
Well, I think that's a great segue into my critiques because I found it a little bit ironic, their version of the song. The song traditionally it's supposed to like really rile people up. It's supposed to use dynamics and in particular getting loud to like really convey the point that yes, nobody sleeps. I will solve this issue, right? I kind of feel like this version fell a little flat, and it might go back to a similar issue with the Sarah Brightman song in that maybe in the recording process, they even things out too much. So you really lost a whole lot of those dynamics. I kind of went into it thinking that maybe he was a growler and he was going to like blow our socks off and like really belt it out, That would have been a super interesting take on the song because that's more in line with like the original intent of it, right? But kind of tweaking it a little bit with a metal tinge. But instead, it was kind of a little bit popera. I think it takes massive balls to cover a song that was really highlighted by Pavarotti.
Yeah.
You can't outdo Pavarotti on this song. You
No.
just can't. So I think no matter who covers this song, unfortunately, they're always going to fall a little bit second to Pavarotti's cover. But yeah, I thought the most interesting part of the song came at the very, very, very end where he screams and it's like the electronic guitar.
Yeah.
That was it. I was like, damn, I wish he gave us more of that because everything else was just kind of felt like he was just kind of going through the motions. Yeah, he totally hit the keys. He was totally singing it. It sounds pretty, but that force behind the melody was missing for me. I wanted him to bring it. You know what I mean? I wanted him to make it a little bit uglier, a little bit rougher, and it was just so pretty.
Yeah. My impression of listening to this version, it makes it feel like a love song, like a sad love song.
Yeah.
But it's not quite right. I mean, there
Right.
is love involved because he, typical dude, right? I must stop at nothing to get this woman. It's like, come on, a little rapey, bro.
Yeah.
And so it just sounds more gentle and sweet the way he sings it, right?
Yeah. Supposed to be some kind of like a level of defiance because in the end, he said, I will win.
Yeah. And it's like super like machismo, right? Like very like, oh,
Yeah.
I am the man for you because I'm going to bring you this. Right. Didn't really convey that in this version of it. Going back to like the orchestra patch, right? Versus using real individual like orchestral instruments. I think it also did a disservice to this cover or this version of it because everything blended too well. His voice blended so well with that orchestral portion, and the orchestral portions also blended too well with each other. Nothing really stuck out. It all kind of like blended, and you wanted something to like pop out at you every now and then, right? Like every now and then you want the singer to like crescendo up into a really like loud part of the song and grab your attention, or you want like some flute or something else from the orchestra itself to like capture your attention, but you just never get that. It's all kind of like blended too well. The producer was too good at his job. They needed to step back and just let things like be loud and obnoxious in different periods of the song, and that just didn't happen.
Yeah, the opera itself is a little problematic for several reasons, like we mentioned. This woman is a prize that can be won, and if a man fights hard enough, he can get what he wants. And also, it doesn't quite portray Asians or the Chinese in most positive light. I don't know, I haven't seen it myself, but just on the fact that you've named the characters Ping Pang Pong is a little little cringy.
I think that's a lot like Ching Chang Chong.
Yes, exactly. For many years, the government of China didn't want this opera performed in China because they didn't feel like it was portrayed Chinese people in the best light. And I can see that just based on what I see right now. I still haven't seen the actual opera, like I said, but it doesn't sound good.
That's not good.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not surprising. A lot of these operas were written really, really, really a long time ago.
Yeah, true.
Where these problematic topics or portrayals weren't really a problem because it was one viewpoint and they didn't care about necessarily being accurate or being inclusive. It was very much one privileged perspective.
I mean, when was this written? Like
1924.
But still, yeah, I mean, at that point, I mean, it was before World War II, too. So
yeah, I mean, and that one in terms of like operas, that's a pretty young, quote unquote, young opera. It's not surprising that there's problems in it.
Like 1980s is problematic now for us.
Exactly.
The things we go back and watch, like, oh my gosh, like, I don't know, like the older movies, like you didn't even notice it. But now, you know, now you watch, it's like, how did we watch that without batting an eye or whatever? It was just the times.
True, true. All right, so out of 5 Manliest Men, what would you rate this? And we'll start with Chris.
Yeah, for me, probably a 3. I mean, like I told you, you know, I have a strong bias against this song because I've listened to it so much of other renditions, right?
Yeah.
Maybe not stealing Sam's point, but after hearing her, it also made sense. Like, kind of like, wish he would do more of like a metal, heavy metal twist on it, right? Whereas he's just kind of like singing popera and until like the very end where he adds like that metal element and the guitar.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. All right. Out of 5 Manliest Men, what do you rate it, Sam?
Out of 5 problematic manliest of men's.
Out of 5 ping pong pongs.
Oh, cringe. I am going to rank it
2.5. Okay. 50%. I'll take it.
And I'm only doing that decimal point because it's your song, Peter. I feel like there was so much potential with this band to cover the song. And I wanted that more, that bit more. But if I took away that expectation, then it'd be like a 3 out of 5.
Yeah. I mean, to give you a little more context of the time is the 90s. And most metal bands that I would say the majority of them that were trying to do any sort of orchestral blending with metal didn't have the funds to have an actual orchestra backing them up.
Yeah.
And so a lot of them just use keyboard sounds, and it's prevalent in like prog metal and all that shit too. Like Nightwish even started off with just keyboard sounds. And then now that they're bigger, they have a full blown orchestra. Dimmu Borgir, same thing. I feel like if this was recorded today, it may be a very different story, but it's a kind of a product of its time too.
Yeah. And that's a fair point. Totally fair.
Todesschmerzen, so bist du meine Tochter. Okay, let's get into the final song. And to lead into this,
It's my song.
I've been trying to hold Sam back from talking about it, but all she wants to do is talk about it. So now is your chance. So this is the opera that Sam and I saw together, and it's our first opera and our last.
And yeah, probably last one too. Backing up though, like we specifically sought out this opera because this song has been my favorite song for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah.
And I've never known the context that this song was in. Like I never knew the story around it. I never even knew what it was about until like I went to that opera. Good Lord. So disappointing. The fuck was that opera about? Like, oh my God, I can't even explain it. It's just random weird shit popping up. And then this one dude was like, it was like the worst male vibrato I've ever heard in my life. It was absolute terrible. It was trash.
Yeah.
Where'd you guys see it? At the SF Opera?
Yes. Yeah. SF Opera House.
And I don't think it was trash because of like the company. Like, I don't think that the actors or the musicians were trash. Yeah. I think Mozart was on crack. And I think his co-writer, Emmanuel Schikaneder,
nailed it.
Let me back up. Sorry. I'm like very passionate and heated about this because fuck. So Mozart wrote the music to the Magic Flute, while his counterpart, Emmanuel Schikaneder, actually like wrote the lyrics and like the plot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And super high flyover weird summary is has something to do with Freemasonry and people originally not liking it, and then characters being like, all right, I get it. This is cool. I like this better. So it's like about a conversion from people being skeptical of Freemasonry into liking it. And then somehow there's ducks and snakes and this murder plot. And that's where this song comes in. I don't even want to spend a lot of time talking about the story because the story is shit. Mozart wrote beautiful music to go with it, but the plot writer was just totally high off of, I don't know, some crazy mushrooms he found in the woods or something.
Or opium.
So it was written back in 1791, right before Mozart died. This song in particular is sung by the Queen of the Night character. So she's kind of like a villain in the story. She's trying to kill the cult leader or Freemason leader. She's trying to kill some dude, but she doesn't want to do it herself. No. She's getting her daughter to do it for her. And if her daughter doesn't do it, she's disowning her daughter. That's the essence of the song is daughter, get your shit together. Go kill this dude for me or else you're dead to me. Right. That's the song in a nutshell. And the song is actually called, okay, bear with me. My German sucks. Der Hölle Rache kocht in meinem Herzen. And it means hell's vengeance boils in my heart. Yeah, she's a very like dark character. She's very reminiscent of like Maleficent,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
When she's on stage, she's in a lot of really cool dark colors and she's like being very loud and like do what I say type character. That's the story behind this. Do you want to add anything to our lovely experience scene? This opera, Peter?
I went into this fully expecting, okay, then I'm going to find out what this high art is about. What all these pretentious motherfuckers is talking about. Okay, I'm going to be cultured just like them. And then there's a point during the opera where I'm like, this is some Dungeons and Dragons sci-fi fantasy shit. But it was just written in 1791. But this is no different than like motherfuckers, Dungeons and Dragons, Game of Thrones, all that shit. There's a point where the main character, Tamino, encounters this big serpent thing. And then there's like three ladies flying in like air balloons or something, like, use this flute to battle the serpent. Do, 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 do. And the serpent goes, oh my God, I can't stand this. Like, what is this? And it just keeps going off the rails. Like you said, Chris, they subtitled it. And I'm like, reading these lyrics. I'm like, this is high art?
Are these accurate translations?
It just got worse and worse. You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing to like see it play out in front of you and you're like, what is this?
Yeah.
And then you read the captions and you're like, what the fuck? Like no. It just gets worse.
But like Queen of the Night, that song, I didn't know where it landed in the opera. Because it's so famous and well-known, I thought, okay, we're going to have to wait until the end to hear it. But in fact, it's like towards the beginning. And then the rest of it, I can just throw away and just leave.
Totally. So we're never going to go to another opera.
Well, I wouldn't say never. I wouldn't say never because this is just one. I don't know. Maybe Carmen is a good choice. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Maybe give yourself a little bit more room because this is just one.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, you know, as we've seen the themes of like the songs that we're talking about, it's like, yeah, it's a different time.
Yeah.
Like, okay, we just got to deal with that. But yeah, the two that we've reviewed, it was not as crazy as this one. And yeah, I didn't even know about the plot until I read it. It's like, oh, wow. Okay. And I didn't even see the other parts. I'm just talking about like this aria.
Yeah.
It was so beautiful. But I'm like, oh, wow, it's really fucked up. Like, and
is.
Dark. I thought they were just singing about flowers or beauty. Nope.
Or a flute, right?
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. Like that's like the high notes that she repeats. That sounds like a flute. Like, so yeah, something beautiful, but it's like, I'm gonna disown you if you don't kill that guy.
Yeah,
actually, Sam, you never mentioned
who does this one. The actual singer for this version is Diana Damrau, but she's a German soprano singer, does opera as a career, and this was one of the operas that she played the Queen of the Night character a lot in her career. And so this is her
like
version.
The de facto like version of this song.
Yeah.
Right.
So Chris, what did you think?
I mean, yeah, it's an iconic song, like aria. I mean, you hear it and you know that, well, you might not know what the actual name of it is or from which opera, but you will recognize it because it's so unique. The arpeggio part, if you're not good, you're going to sound like shit. I mean, kudos to her singer. She hit it like right on. And you know, in my mind also as a musician, it's like, okay, you might be like a little flat or a little sharp on one of those arpeggios because it's so easy, like you're jumping all around, right?
Yeah.
And if you just fuck up one note, you're like, no.
Yeah.
But she got it like perfect.
Yeah. And it's very staccato, right? Like there's no
yeah.
sliding into it. There's
exactly
no,
yeah, and there's no
there's
cheating.
No room for error.
There's no Sarah
yeah.
Brightman cheating.
Yeah. There's no vibrato. It's very like sharp quick notes that are just like doing these really quick runs all through the song.
In some ways some people use it as like a standard of like how well of a soprano you are, if you can sing the song or not.
Yeah.
Or how well can you sing the song, right?
That's the main thing that kind of drew me to the song was its technical complexity. Like from the very beginning, I was like, holy shit, how do you sing that? It covers two octave ranges. It has so many coloraturas. So a coloratura is like a combination of like a run and trills and like these staccato, like these dynamics. It's all kind of like categorized or called one big coloratura. And this song just has it all throughout. And you're just like, God damn, like that's 2 minutes there of like full on like singing your heart out. There's this one story that I read that made me crack up. One lady in particular who's famous for singing this song terribly.
I want to see this.
Like she's like some socialite back, I think, in the 20s or something. Or maybe the 40s.
Somebody did a movie about her. Like she's a notoriously bad singer.
Oh, yes. Like, yes. She's a socialite and she's a terrible singer, but she loves to sing.
Yep.
And so she'll like sing these really hard songs at parties and stuff like that. And people will just like make fun of her and laugh at her. And she's like, ah, fuck you. I don't care. I'm going to sing this song off key. So this song, though, like Mozart wrote it for his sister-in-law. Because she had such a great control of her voice and he wanted to showcase it. And he really felt like her, this is a new word that I learned. Tessitura. Have you heard of that?
What is that?
A tessitura is a portion of a singer's range where they feel really comfortable singing. So for this song, apparently Mozart's sister-in-law, her tessitura was really high in her range.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was maybe inspired him to write all of those like super staccato quick runs throughout the song that you'll hear just like blows your mind. You're like, what the fuck just happened? How like, how did you just sing that? Do it again. Do it slower. But yeah. Any more comments, Chris?
I mean, that she sang it perfectly. I think that's probably one of the best versions I've heard. It makes sense that she's the de facto. But song-wise, I mean, it's a lot of, like you said, coloratura. Or yeah, a lot of runs and, you know, like the trills. And yeah, it's very technical. So kudos to her. I have nothing else to say, really, other than, you know, the fucked up storyline.
Yeah.
That is in contrast with the beauty of this song.
All right, Peter, what do you think?
Like you, Sam, I've known this song for quite some time because it's in our collective lives. We hear it several times, whether it be in commercials. I actually think this song was in a car commercial. Yeah, like the rest of it, like listening to it as a whole, of course, it starts off like quickly, an opening chord, and then all of a sudden she's fucking singing. So to be able to hear that chord really quick and just jump into the song, pretty amazing. Like the beginning of it, the verses, I guess you could say, is sung in the classical operatic style with a very heavy vibrato. Then you get to the famous part, which is what we're all talking about, the crazy runs. And yeah, I had the same thoughts as you two. There's no vibrato to hide behind. It's insanely fast runs that goes between octaves, and you cannot fuck it up. There's no room to fuck it up. If you fuck it up, exactly, nowhere to hide. It's even worse because it's such a high octave, because growing up in a music school, Sam would know this, you hear the scales all day long, and you hear it on a piano, fine. You hear it on a trumpet, it can be a little scuffed, but it's okay. You hear it on a flute or a piccolo, it just makes you want to like stab your ears out. It's so high pitched and so like, and violins too, when a violin sounds shitty.
Oh God.
Oh my God, dude, it's nothing worse. So if you try to sing this and you butcher it, I can see it being even worse. There's another part to this too, not just the famous chorus, but there's a, I don't know, would you call it a bridge? Where it goes, that part. Like that whole long ass run.
Yeah, I think that's the bridge.
That part is not as famously well known, but it's equally or maybe even harder because it's way longer.
Yeah.
All in all, this song is a technical marvel. Anybody that tries to sing this, props to you. And anyone that nails it, big, big props. And when we saw this live, I was like, here it comes. How's she going to do? Whoever that singer was that night, crushed it.
Nailed it.
Yeah. It's not just singing when this is performed. There's a whole performance that goes with it too. So it's another layer of something to think about when you're performing this. You're not just straight up singing it. So,
or emoting and stuff.
Dana Damrau, props to you. It's a great version.
The best version I've heard so far.
Yeah.
All right. Chris, so out of 5 magical mushrooms, how many magical mushrooms would you rank this song?
A 5.
Woo!
Disregarding, you know, the the story, it's quite a perfect rendition of this aria.
Nice. And Peter, out of 5 magical mushrooms, what would you rank this song?
Yeah, I would have to give this a 5 out of 5 magical mushrooms too. There's nothing I can fault out of this. Yeah, like Chris said, story, brush that aside. And, you know, it does start off with crazy over-the-top vibrato, which is something we've established that not all of us are fans of. I can brush all that aside and just look at the technicality, the singing, you know, one of the most famous lines in opera. You know, it's not just technical. It's a nice melody, too. I mean, that's important because you could have shredding all day long and it just doesn't sound like anything memorable. But this is very memorable. So to tread that line between technicality and what's the word I'm looking for? Being able to remember or having it be an earworm is not something many composers achieve. It's either one or the other. Either you have this pop song that's like a simple line, or you have a technical marvel that it's not something you can necessarily sing or remember, but this hits both marks very well.
Agreed.
Okay, so let's wrap things up here. To cap all of this, I wanted to talk about a very famous saying, it ain't over till the fat lady sings. What are your thoughts on this slightly offensive saying?
I mean, yeah, because like the picture that comes to my mind is, you know, Flight of the Valkyries, right? And then you would picture like a fat woman like singing that operatic line or whatever.
Yeah.
I never really read about like how that came to be, or you know, but yeah, that's just my picture. And I just thought, oh, maybe like it's her last note. So if she sings that, then it's like, okay, the opera is over.
So I don't know where it came from, but I don't really find it offensive. I just kind of wish that entertainment at large and opera is in that vein, right? Would get away from aesthetics and looks and focus more on like the talent and and the story. And I feel like we're getting way better. We're starting to get so much more representation. Like we're getting so much more representation, not only of like different cultures and different type of people, but also different body types and that kind of thing. And I think that will help move us into like a much better society and definitely a much better entertainment realm. This saying I don't find offensive. I kind of embrace it and I kind of like it because it kind of speaks to the fact that, hey, you know, you can be thicker and still produce beautiful music and still be healthy and still, you know, get shit done. You can, you know, you can do more than what everybody thinks being fat is all about. So yeah, I embrace it and I own it. I like this one.
Yeah. According to Wikipedia, at least, it started off as a sports saying.
Huh.
It was first recorded, apparently, in the Dallas Morning News in 1976. And this guy was referencing sports. And it's kind of one of those things where, is this team out of contention? And it's like, no, it's not over until the fat lady sings. And just from there, it just blew up. And it's something we've said over and over again. It's something people say over and over again. But I just wanted to highlight this because it makes me think of old school opera. A buxom lady would be regarded as more prestigious. They would be typically be singing these arias. They were looked up upon as the pop stars of the day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And looking at it now, pop stars are not supposed to look like this. You're supposed to look thin. You're supposed to look fit and all that shit. It's quite a change in what the standard is. And so there's just a stereotype of what an opera singer should look like, and it's generally a more buxom lady. And so, like you, Sam, I think it's something more to be celebrated that this body shape can be highly respected and seen in such a high regard. Nowadays, the culture has shifted significantly.
Yeah, to bullshit.
At the end of the day, it shouldn't matter whether you're heavy, thin, in between, whatever you look like. It comes down to, can you sing? Do you have the talent?
Agreed.
Okay, so the fat lady has sung, and that ends our collaboration, our second collaboration with Chris. Chris, I want to thank you very much once again.
No, thanks for having me. This is fun.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chris.
We appreciate your time. It was a blast, and this was probably something we would not have done on our own. Thank you also for, you know, getting us out of our comfort zone, doing something different, and celebrating a musical style that's a part of us in some way, but it's not a part of my regular rotation to put on opera.
Nope. Yeah. Well, Sarah Brightman's maybe, but yeah, like not hardcore.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to just throw on Mozart's entire opera and listen to it in its entirety. That's not my thing. Even though I am a completionist album listener when it comes to opera, not so much. I just pick and choose the songs I like. Yeah, this is different for us and hopefully different for our listeners. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate your time with us today.
Thanks, guys.
Happy Opera Day.
Happy Opera Day, Happy everybody. Opera Day. Thank you for listening to Two Songs, One Couple.
If you like what you hear and you want more, find us on
Spotify,
Apple Podcasts,
twosongsonecouple.com,
Facebook,
Twitter,
and Instagram.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Oh,
He just like I saw his. It looked like he was having a seizure. Like his body just like. It's like everything inside of him, every single muscle, just like simultaneously, just like coming at once, and then that note comes out.
Ooh, 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 ooh.